from the Sky News Centre at 5. Investigations being launched to find out if we're paying too much for our energy bills. Ofgem says companies' profit margins have soared from £65 on a standard dual fuel tariff to £90 after they put up their prices for customers. Some people are suspicious about whether they're being treated fairly.
They need to stop creaming the profit off, and if they are, then that should definitely be investigated.
Everybody else has to put up their prices, don't they? It's the way of life. That's how I accept it.
I mean, it's disgusting. There's lots of old people shivering at home at the moment. The third world are better off than we are at the moment.
A reckless lorry driver who drove onto a level crossing and caused a train crash has been jailed for 15 months. Arvidas Bartasius has also been handed a 3-year driving ban. 21 people were hurt in the crash in August near Sudbury in Suffolk. Parts of the country have been brought to a standstill by an earlier than usual cold snap. Up to 6 inches of snow has already fallen in some areas, with more on the way over the next 2 weeks. It's emerged the man leading the government's independent banking industry review has described the decision to approve Lloyds TSB's merger with HBOS as a mistake. It's emerged that Sir John Vickers wrote the comments in a paper 4 weeks before his appointment. X Factor reject Gamu has been given hope she may be allowed to stay in the UK. The Home Office has agreed to reconsider a ruling which ordered her family to return to their native Zimbabwe. Gamu's lawyer, Francis Farrell, says it's now a waiting game.
It's open to them to either issue another refusal, against which there would definitely be a right of appeal, so that issue's gone, or it's open to them to grant my clients leave.
Football, and we now know the identities of all of the match officials for this weekend's SPL games. There'll be referees from Luxembourg, Israel and Portugal. Scottish refs are going on strike over the amount of criticism they've received. That's the latest. I'm Sean Allen Moy.
Community FM 93.2.
BCFM Travel News, in association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
In Cornwall, there's snow affecting the A30 around Bodmin on the Bodmin Bypass and across Bodmin Moor. Traffic is slow in both directions on the A30 as a result. M5 in Somerset and around Bristol affected by snow and sleet as well. And if you're going north on the M5 past Bristol, that's slow from junction 17 at Cribbs Causeway up towards the M4 interchange. The westbound M4 going past Bristol is queuing before junction 19, the M32 turning for Bristol, and then slow through towards the M5 junction at Almondsbury. That's affecting the M32 coming out of Bristol, which is queuing for the whole length of the motorway. The M5 in Gloucestershire has queuing traffic on both the exit slip roads at junction 12 on the south side of Gloucester. And the northbound A46 going towards the M4 junction 18 roundabouts looking heavy. In Wiltshire, traffic in Salisbury on the A36 Southampton Road is queuing at the College roundabout. And then going west from Salisbury towards Wilton, traffic slow between the Park Wall traffic lights and the A30 Wilton roundabout. And if you're going west on the M4 into South Wales, there's snow affecting traffic from just after the second Severn crossing through towards junction 29, which is the A48M turning for Cardiff. Traffic stop-start for about 14 miles. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm joined this week by Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Alistair Watson. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, we've heard from the students, but what about the lecturers? They're by no means happy with the planned LibCon hike in tuition fees. We'll hear from Dr. Lee Salter from the University of the West of England. And British Army veterans who had their health affected by nuclear tests back in the 1950s have lost their case for compensation. What does this say about claims that may be brought in the future by present soldiers and their families? And finally, could the solution to the financial crisis be simpler than we think? Alex Milne is here to talk about what he believes to be answers in, of all places, the Bible. And that's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, snow is continuing this evening around the Bristol area till about 9 p.m. This weekend, highs of only 1 degree Celsius, so that means that the snow won't be settling, and fairly cloudy, but possibly no more snow for the rest of the weekend. Next week, highs of 1 degree Celsius, really cold, fairly dry, with some sunny spells, some likelihood of light snow next week. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of December, highs of 1 degree and fairly dry with some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Alistair Watson. Hi, Alistair, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Nice to be here.
Now, first of all, what's your background? What were you doing before you got into politics?
Well, I mean, I still do a day job as well, because I'm a councillor, so I still have to make some money. I do training, management-type training, project management training, and consultancy as well.
So do you think it's actually fine for politicians to also have full-time jobs as well at the same time?
Oh, I think for council work, certainly not as an MP. I certainly think that if you're in the House of Commons and you're paid a reasonable salary, then certainly not, no. But council work is different. And if I was on the cabinet in the council, then I certainly think those are full-time posts. But most of us have to work as well as do our council work as well.
So what committees are you on as part of your role on the City Council?
The committees that I'm on, I was only voted in May, so I'm pretty new on this, and I've taken over the role as the Conservative lead on Children and Young People Services, and I'm on the Scrutiny Commission for what we always call the CYPS, but Children's Services, which includes schools, education, but also children in care and children who are being safeguarded and so on.
But isn't your role being sort of marginalised? Because we heard last week from Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, that they're talking about now taking control from Westminster of local schools.
I doubt if Michael Gove would have said that, actually, because in fact that's quite the opposite of what he wants to do. Taking control of the schools is not what he wants to do. What he's doing is giving the schools their own control. But actually, I mean, I was really interested. I mean, this week the Education White Paper came out, which is quite an interesting document, and I don't think it got enough airplay. I mean, it is going to make a huge difference to how education is delivered in the city, but the City Council is going to have more of a role than we thought before the White Paper. Now, the City Council will have a different role. They won't be running the schools, but we'll still be in charge of all the admissions. But also, there's a role to ensure quality and performance of schools. So it's, I think it's a different role, but it's certainly a very important one in education.
So what is a white paper, apart from piecing a piece of paper that's white?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the paper that goes before the legislation. So it'll be voted on in Parliament. If it goes through, it becomes law. So I mean, the difference between that and a green paper, obviously, green paper is more of a discussion document. So this is, I suppose, I mean, and I've read through it, and I don't suppose many people are going to read through the whole 95 pages of this white paper. But it's more of a strategic document. It doesn't tell you the detail. It tells you that there will be a pupil premium. I mean, that's one of the things the Lib Dems were certainly trying to get in, and I totally agree with it as well. I'm a councillor. I'm a governor at Henbury School in Bristol, and we're certainly looking forward to some of the detail on that to see, you know, what monies we'll be getting through in our budget in the coming year. But the detail's not there, but it's a strategic document.
So, in the wider picture, you've just been elected this year as a councillor for the first time. What made you decide to get into politics?
I've been in politics a lot of my life. I got involved initially at university quite a while ago, back in the 70s. I was at university between 74 and 78. That was an exciting time to be involved in student politics. I got involved then. I sort of stepped out of politics for a number of years. I went to live in New Zealand for a while, came back to this country, and started again in the late 80s, early 90s. Personally, not a great fan of Margaret Thatcher, so, you know, John Major was my somebody I felt more affinity for as a more inclusive Prime Minister. So got involved at that stage, and I've run for Westminster twice. 2001, I I was the candidate for Cardiff North, and I stood for Bristol North West in 2005.
Yes, but the big question is, why did you choose the Conservatives and not one of the other parties? What's so special about your Tories?
I think you choose a party dependent on what your sort of core beliefs are, and my core beliefs are that people take responsibility, but they're also, you know, given the powers to do what they want to do. I think that if you join the Labour Party, you have to believe in a centralised control system. You know, whether you call yourself a socialist or not, it is certainly the other end of the spectrum. And my view is that I believe totally in the free market.
Yeah, but the free market isn't really working with the city right now, is it?
Well, you say that. It's worked a lot better than the Soviet Union worked, or China maybe is working. So, you know, I mean, it has its ups and downs.
Isn't it quite ruthless, the free market? Is there a sort of ruthless side to it?
You do have to have regulation, and I think, every generation has to go through some of these pain barriers, I suppose, and, you know, maybe we forget the... some of the lessons of previous generations, but yeah, I mean, it needs regulating. Obviously, you know, greed on its own is not good, and in the main, the free market is, I think, is what we have to do, and also free market in, you know, how services are delivered.
Now, what about some of the big issues in the city right now? What are your thoughts about the stadium? Because this has been rumbling on for such a long time now and still not quite come to a conclusion. In Ashton Vale, Bristol City Football Club want a new stadium. Do you think they should have it there?
Oh, I think they should certainly have it, and I'm very, very much supportive of them.
But it's a greenfield site, isn't it? And another aspect, the Conservatives are actually arguing very strongly against the sell-off of parks and open spaces. So why are you for that particular piece of open space being built on by the football club?
Well, it's not in Bristol City, you see, so we don't mind.
Just outside.
Yeah, just outside. Now, of course, I mean, you know, there has to be development, and we are against the sell-off of green sites that are important to local communities and are valuable to those local communities. Now, obviously, there are some people who would argue that this is an important green site, the people who live next to it. I think, you know, there'll always be somebody who wants to keep any green site, but we have to have development as well. We've got to move forward. It's the best option. It ticks most of the boxes, and I'd like to see it built.
Well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me too. Now, Martin, how are we going to pay? Because we're going to be hearing from students in a minute. But how can we pay for students' tuition fees? Simply, you know, the country's bust, isn't it?
Well, yes, the country's bust.
I mean, it's in a way pointless, the students arguing, because there just isn't the money for them.
No. Well, this brings us back to macroeconomic questions about whether we should be cutting at all. Because, of course, we've seen what's happened in Ireland. Cutting actually leads to a bigger deficit, and then you lose your credit rating, which is possibly where we're going. So the students are quite right to oppose the policy, because, in factual fact, that cutting is not necessarily the macroeconomic choice we should be making.
But surely...
Leaving that aside, there was perfectly good, sensible suggestions made before the election by various parties for a graduate tax to pay for education. That was kicked into the long grass by the coalition, and we can't possibly discuss it, but it was certainly discussed before the election.
But surely what's happened here is basically the family, British family, has overused its credit card, it's maxed out its credit card, and there simply isn't any more money left. It's bad housekeeping.
This is how the Condem government have presented the issue, and they've been rather successful, because of course most people do think in this rather mechanistic way about the economy, that if we've spent more than we've earned, then we've just got to cut back. But of course, the Conservative governments in the 1950s used to know this: you can't cut your way out of a recession, and attempts to cut our way out of a recession are going to lead us down the road of Ireland, Greece, Portugal, etc. There's going to have to be a complete shake-up of the financial sector, and I was looking to a Conservative government to do it. If the Conservative government that was prepared to take on the financial sector would be a boon and a blessing. But sadly, I'm afraid, we've got a government of bankers for bankers.
Isn't it just actually a lot simpler than that? There just simply isn't any money left in the coffers.
There's plenty of money. There's been a big bubble over the last 30 years under Thatcher
and
under New Labour.
It's been built on debt.
Some people have done indeed. And some people have done very well out of the deregulation of the financial markets in the 1980s. Very well indeed. They started off as millionaires, and many of them are now billionaires. The country is broke, as you say, and therefore we got to have something proper. Greg Philo from Glasgow University made a suggestion a few weeks ago. Why don't we have a one-off wealth tax? Why don't we find out what everybody's wealth is actually worth? And don't forget, some people have done very well out of the last 30 years, very well indeed. And then we decide how much we need to reflate the economy, and we have a one-off wealth tax. That's how we funded the Hundred Years' War. It's what the sort of thing you have to do. And during the 1950s, when we had a Conservative government, the top rate of tax was in the 90% range. And that was when conservatism was conservative.
But it's not the Hundred Years' War at the moment. It's the 21st century. And anyone with wealth who's going to have it taxed is probably going to just move it offshore.
Well, in that case, we had these discussions in Eastern Europe when we were talking about the reform of the economy in Eastern Europe. And it is very difficult to get wealthy people to pay their taxes. It's true, especially Russian mafiosi. But, of course, all of them ultimately have to invest in property, because property is it's underpinned the bubble, for example, in Britain. Property taxes are the way to get the money out of people, because property can't run away.
OK, well, let's go on to have a look at some of this week's stories. And at the top of the list is Britain's energy giants, who were today shamed by shock figures showing that they're making £90 per customer. This is from The Sun, actually. And Ofgem, who regulate the energy industry, said that profit margins in the energy sector have soared by 40% in the last 3 months alone. Well, Alistair, I'm going to have to get you to answer this, because it doesn't sound like the regulators are able to really do their job. In 3 months, they've hiked up the price of energy 40%. 40%.
Yeah, I know, and I think it's extremely insensitive going into winter when people are going to find the difficult to pay for energy, which, and they're going to have to use quite a bit. Come in the next couple of weeks, I think we're all going to be switching our heaters on and getting our boilers going.
Well, some of us won't afford to be able to afford
to.
I
think it's shocking. I think that there is a problem with this market, because it isn't a proper market. And I'm sure an economist like Martin will know more about these sort of things than I do. But I mean, what I've done, and I would ask everybody to think about this, go on to uSwitch, and I mean, I did that last week when I started to hear about this. And the more people that go and switch, the more we get a better market, the more it becomes more competitive. And you know, hopefully people like British Gas will see that their customers will flood away from them into the cheaper.
I wonder what's going
supplies.
On with this little regulator, Ofgem, because they sound a bit toothless. He says, one of their spokespeople says here, we urge any company that has been charging too much for their energy to reduce their prices and refund any overcharges to consumers. Well, we urge, well, that's not going to get them very far, does it?
It doesn't sound like they're really going into bat for the consumer, does it?
No.
And, I think they do need to get a bit more robust on that one, I have to say, because we are in a situation that is a regulated market, and they need to be regulating it. So you know, I certainly think that they shouldn't be allowing these companies to, rather than get more competitive and more efficient, they just allow them to put the prices up and retain their profit margins, which I think is the wrong thing. Most of the rest of industry is having to go the other way and keep prices steady whilst trying to make savings and improve efficiency.
Martin, can you shed any light on the economics of this? How are they able to get away with 40% rises in 3 months?
I think Alistair's quite right. This isn't really a competitive market, and so the privatisation of gas and electricity was always going to lead to these kind of conflicts and tensions.
But there are at least 10 different energy suppliers. I mean, it's surely they're competing with each other.
Yeah, but this is a kind of mistake that people make. For example, when we're talking about buses, they say we'll get more competition, that will reduce the fares. In economics textbooks, they talk about several different kinds of markets. Free markets, as Alistair was talking about earlier, have to have lots and lots of small producers, and in those kind of markets, competition does lead to price cuts. But most markets are actually not free markets. They are, in fact, natural monopolies or oligopolies. This is an oligopoly, really.
And what does that mean?
Well, that means basically it means that you've got a small number of large firms. 10 firms is a small
number. You say
number.
That there are sort of cartel working together?
Effectively, yes, that's what happens. And that's what happens in a lot of industries, like the car industry, for example. You'll notice that all the cars in a certain range all tend to be about the same price. And that's not because they're colluding, it's because they're keeping an eye on each other.
Well, it sounds like this regulator, Ofgem, needs beefing up a bit, doesn't it?
Well, exactly. But I mean, the point is that in the old days when it was run by the government, The point is that you could you priced energy at its marginal cost to supply. There was no extra market for profit, and you could in fact subsidise certain people to have energy if you wanted to. That lever is no longer available to government, and so then these things come along and smack us in the eye, and the government doesn't seem to have any mechanism for doing anything about it. We've got a regulator there, but it's a toothless regulator, so what can we do? We can throw up our hands and go, what can we do? I mean, we've deliberately backed ourselves into a corner where we can't do anything about it. Of course, something should be done about it. Beefing up the regulator is an obvious first step, but you might want to think about, in the long run, in other countries, they have their energy industries controlled by the government.
Yeah, it's very nice being able to debate these topics with a proper, good old socialist point of view, and rather than, because I don't think the Labour Party would now hold the views of
no,
Martin.
They don't. They don't.
Martin holds. But I don't think we want to go back to the old days of state regulation on these things. I mean, we know that, in fact, actually, it probably cost even more if the state regulated it, because they were grossly inefficient, and they had absolutely no incentive for more efficiency. At least now there is some incentive, and I think all the power companies are worried about the regulator. So there is some pressure on them.
What's the difference between the state regulating it, say, for the Department of Energy, as it, I guess, eons ago it used to be, and Ofgem?
Well, I don't think the state actually the state actually delivered it. So there was nobody actually, apart from government and perhaps the department would put a bit of pressure on, but nobody had any incentive. It's
don't you think that some of these utilities, it actually makes sense for them to be controlled by the government rather than part of some sort of artificial free market?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we've seen actually quite a lot of benefits from privatisation. People still, would say, look at the good old days, etc. But actually, if you looked at the good old days, the trains were worse than they were today. The buses
Buses are a good example of how privatisation has been actually not really worked in Bristol. The fares now are being hiked up. Buses are being cancelled in certain areas where there's not enough profit for first pass. Mm.
But the fares were, I mean, people used to say that when they were run by the council as well, back in those so-called good old days, the buses didn't run on time, they were old, there was never any investment in new stock and so on. So, now we have got better buses, we've got better information about them. Apart from the difficulties of the traffic congestion, they're more reliable. They are too expensive, and I agree with that. And I think there needs to be some competition in there to try and bring prices down.
But back to this story about energy price hikes. We hear from the Daily Mail that 9 pensioners died from cold every hour last winter. And we're hearing this just now as bill prices are soaring. So this could be a matter of life and death for some people, this hike in energy prices.
It could indeed, because I think that some people have real difficulty in paying for some of the there are services available, and I think it's some people who don't access those services that have the problems. There are benefits that are paid, but perhaps some of these pensioners are a bit too proud, or maybe they're a little bit too confused. We've got to do more to try and find the people who are having difficulty, and to make sure that they're getting the full range of benefits that they need. And if they do, they will be able to pay for their fuel supplies this winter.
It's been a shocking indictment of Britain over many generations that we have this problem of old people dying of cold in the winter. In other countries in Northern Europe, like Finland or Sweden, this simply doesn't happen, because they have actually got a much more regulated market than we've got. And they've got a much better welfare system than we've got. And in actual fact, that's what Britain ought to look like. And of course, they've also got municipal buses in places like Stockholm, which are run at a loss, or rather subsidised by the government. I don't think that the Scandinavians are inefficient or failing. In many ways, they've got a much higher productivity per worker than we've got. And that's where Britain ought to be, but we're not, because we've wasted a whole generation on free market nonsense.
Thank you. Now we're going to go on to another story. And earlier on this week, on Wednesday, you may have been stuck, if you're in your car in Bristol city centre, in a bit of a jam, because rather than going to London to protest, Bristol students chose Wednesday to protest in the city centre. So let's go back to Ollie's programme on BCFM here at 4 o'clock and hear live back on Wednesday from one of the students in the city centre.
It started with a big rally outside Senate House, which is a Bristol University building. There was, I don't know, upwards of 3,000 or 4,000 people there. It's really hard to say. Mostly college students, I must say, as they're the ones that are actually going to get nailed by this assault on the education sector. But there was a lot of university students there as well. It's a fantastic mix. And then from there, everyone marched down Park Street. The police then blockaded the bottom of Park Street, wouldn't let anyone pass, so we marched back up to the Union Building. That's when people started got in there and tried to have a debate, which was then blocked. So then everyone marched back down onto College Green, and then the police again blocked people off. So then we went back through the city of Bristol College with, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of college students who were marching and chanting no ifs, no buts, no education cuts, and so on and so forth. A police van then turned up, about 20 police jumped out of the vans. Then everyone got kind of pushed out of that building back onto College Green. Then the people were kind of standing around, it was quite peaceful, and the police, there's a great deal of mounted police. And they basically launched a kind of a kettle, which is where you surround a group of protesters, which really caused a great deal of agitation. That a couple of arrests occurred. I personally, one of my friends, I saw get arrested. He hadn't done anything. There was a surge in the crowd and the police just plucked people away. So, I mean, I don't know how many other people have been arrested, but I mean, that was totally an unnecessary action on behalf of the police. It seems to have calmed down now. We've marched back up Park Street. There's a bunch of people blocked off in a... we're at the triangle at the moment.
So where you took the... took the moment?
I'm outside Browns. There's loads of police are everywhere. It seems to have calmed down, but they've blockaded a whole bunch of people in a square. A whole bunch of kind of college students and university students. Basically, they're all kind of in there. And they don't seem to be letting them out, so people are kind of congregating here. But, I mean... it's just been, it's been a kind of fantastic success as far as I'm concerned. This is a real demonstration that, you know, we're not apathetic, we are totally engaged, and we're perfectly aware that this is what happens when a government wages war, basically, on education. People want it, and there's no need for the cuts that they're trying to force through either. I mean, why is there no money for education? But there is money, there's £20 billion to renew the Trident nuclear weapon system. Do you know what I mean? I mean, when they try and make that argument that there just isn't enough money, it's farcical. If there's no money, why aren't they reclaiming the £150 billion that's lost each year through tax evasion, primarily by the super rich who can pay accountants and such to organise that sort of behaviour? I mean, it's a sham, you know what I mean? It's a sham. People are showing their anger.
Do you reckon this is going to make a difference?
Absolutely. It's making a difference now to everyone involved, everyone who can see it. This is fantastic, you know. This is exactly what we need. I mean, if people don't do this sort of thing, then they just walk all over us, you know what I mean?
So that was from Wednesday this week on Ollie's show from 4 till 5. A student called Steve in Bristol City Centre as part of the student protest. I'll come to you first, Alistair, a Conservative councillor. Can you tell us whether you think it's actually OK for the students to do this kind of thing? I mean, some would say they're just rampaging around town.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I think, you know, people need to get involved in politics. Peaceful protest is absolutely number one. I think it's tremendous to see that young people have you know, got motivated. I would like to also say that I was down there on Wednesday afternoon. I did pass some students, and there's a bit of a one-sided version. I heard them talking about how they'd had a go at some of the police, and hey, you know, you missed this, mate, because you know, we had a go, and you know, we had a real good fight, you know, for a bit. So that, you know, there were people that went down there just to stir things up. Luckily, I mean, the police presence was good. I think in the main they kept it well controlled, and the students had a chance to make their protest, which is fantastic.
Well, one of the points he was making there was that after the main part of the demonstration. Some of the students went into, I think it's Berkeley Square at the top of Park Street, and were sort of just about sort of having a chat and ready to go home when the police surrounded them and started one of these kettles where the police surround them. It doesn't seem that it may have been a bit unnecessary. What do you think about that?
Yes, I mean, I wasn't there, and I think that you know, you'd have to speak to somebody from the police side of things on why they did that. There was a lot of police around. I think they were wary of demonstrations, even one on this scale, because of what had happened in London. And but I didn't see any heavy-handed stuff. But I wasn't in Berkeley Square, I have to say, when that happened. But I know that they were trying to sideline some of the troublemakers away from the main body, so that the ones that were out there doing peaceful demonstrations could do it.
What about the point that Steve was making there? The $150 billion in tax avoidance could pay for their tuition fees.
Well, yes, if you can get it.
Or the money for the Trident. Do you support the Trident submarine, or what it is, the Trident weapons system, which is also one of these multi-billion pound projects, which, you know, because, I mean, for the students' point of view, I mean, even quite a lot of youngsters who haven't even gone to university yet with this protest this week are thinking, well, actually, we don't really want to start our working lives saddled with this such a massive debt, up to nearly £50,000.
Yes, I know, and it does sound quite scary. I mean, but, you know, there are a lot of safeguards in there, and I think the poorer students will be getting grant help as well. But, you know, if you want to send the amount of students or the amount of young people to university, it's got to be paid for. And I always think, you know, people like Martin say, you know, this should be free or this whatever, you know, soak the rich and whatever. In the end, it's taxpayers. You know, this is not money from government. It's not given away by the Treasury. It's us taxpayers, and we have to decide what we want to spend our money on. And taxpayers, you know, they pay a lot of tax every year, and I think people spend their money better themselves than the government does. So the government should only take the amount of money that's required. And we have to do things like look after the elderly, make sure that the poor can pay for their fuel bills and all the rest of it. So taxpayers have got a lot to do. You know, people are out of work, perhaps for no reason of their own, and so on. Students, they're going to get better jobs in the future. I think actually they'll value their degree better. I mean, both my sons went to university, and I made sure that, you know, they took out their loans, because I felt that, you know, then they saw that, you know, they were having to put something into this. It wasn't just mum and dad subbing them for a few years, having a good time up on a university campus.
Well, what about Alistair's point there, Martin, that people should be decide for themselves how their money is spent, rather than have it taken off them by the taxpayer? I mean, surely it's much more sensible.
By the government, you mean, by the taxpayer.
No,
I mean, taxes are just one of the things that are part of having a civilised society. I was talking earlier about Scandinavian countries. They have much higher levels of tax than we do, and they're much more efficient than we are. What we have got is a much more inequality in our society. We're nearly as unequal as the United States of America. Now, that's just not efficient. It's just not an efficient way to run things. There's a marginal utility of money. Up to your first million, it's worth having. But beyond that, it starts to get less and less useful to you. And we're now in a situation where billionaires who've had their financial system bailed out by the taxpayer — this is why we've got no money, because we bailed out the private banking system, which has collapsed and is insolvent. That's the fundamental problem. Now, we had two years treading water where governments were supposed to get to grips with the beast that is the financial markets. They didn't. And as I say, we've now got a government by bankers for bankers.
But that's a Labour government, Martin.
Oh, indeed. I totally agree. I mean, what's happened over a generation is that the new Labour settlement was to accept the deregulation of the city. That was a major failing of new Labour. And of course, it all blew up in their faces in 2008. Now, what people have got to recognise is that whole era of the market knows best is simply blown out of the water. There is no intellectual credibility to it. And we've actually got to go back and have a look at how we used to run things from 1945 to 1973. And Conservative governments used to run things in this way. Edward Heath and Harold Macmillan would not be cutting public expenditure at this moment. The Tory party has drifted far to the right since those days, far to the right. And in actual fact, we're going to see in the new year, if the deficit gets bigger and we start falling into a hole like the Irish, I can't see this government lasting to the end of 2011.
Well, Martin makes a good point there, doesn't he, Alistair, that, you know, the Irish have done what the IMF told them to do. Now Britain has done what the IMF told. Surely we're going to end up having to bail out the banks all over again.
We're bailing out the Irish banks. George Osborne has given $7 billion to bail out. It's not the Irish banks, it's bailing out the British banks because they're owed money by Ireland.
What about this point then, that you can't actually cut your way out of a recession?
I think you have to. I mean, I think you have to put your own house in order. I mean, you know, and I think there's a political consensus on this. You know, and Martin is obviously an economist, and you know, he's got his own models that he works to. But you know, you get several economists in a room, and you'll get several different opinions about this. And I think the consensus opinion is that just in the way that, you know, if it was our own money, you know, in the family, you know, you can't just go on spending your way out of a financial problem. You've got to draw in, and you've got to make those savings. I think you know, the Labour government was spending far too much. The deficit we've got is a legacy of that time. We have to cut. Now, I think the Irish have got a worse deficit, and they're going to be in real trouble.
So can you see why the students are angry? Because many of them were voting for the Liberals. I mean, I realise that's not your party. Yes. In the hope that actually there would be abolition of tuition fees. And then we're told that actually David Cameron had done a deal with Nick Clegg before the election that if they went into coalition, that he would drop this policy completely. So I put it to you that this is why the students are so angry.
Oh, I absolutely can see why the students are angry, and I think that there's going to be a protest at Stephen Williams's offices, I think, in the next few days, isn't there, to protest that. I mean, that, you know, he got a lot of student votes by saying that, you know, he wanted to abolish fees. Well, of course, the Liberal Democrats could say anything they wanted to before the election because they didn't think they were going to be in power, and I think all of us can do that. Now they're in power, they see the reality of what can be done, and of course it's not government. I keep saying this, it's not government that pays it, it's taxpayers that pay for it, and taxpayers have only got a certain tolerance of what they're willing to pay for. You know, students, you know, should actually do something for themselves in that respect. So
yeah, I mean, we've got to start talking seriously about taxation. Taxpayers can't afford this tax. I mean, there's a huge disparity in wealth in this country. 1% of the population of Britain controls 50% of the wealth. The bottom 50% has 6% of the wealth between them, and that's all at the top decile. So most people have got no wealth at all, at least one third of the population. The economy has been run under Conservative and New Labour governments to maximise the take of the people at the top. Their tax rates have gone down enormously. At the end of the Second World War, people knew that the wealthy had to pay their way.
But we've had the new bankers' tax as well.
And the Labour Party did very well for generations by saying, vote for us and we will make them pay for your services. Not you, them. I mean, we should take low-income people out of the tax system altogether. Now, we're not going to take these radical policies forward until we've had a crash. And that's what's going to happen. We'll have a crash. The government will collapse in chaos, and then we will start talking seriously about what to do. Ed Balls in the Labour leadership campaign, I didn't vote for him, but one of the things he was suggesting is we've got to have a crash programme of building council houses. Andy Burnham, I didn't vote for him, but he said what we've got to do is look at things like land value taxation. Now, what's interesting to me is that the Labour Party is at last talking about economics,
yes,
which we haven't been doing for a generation.
But after 13 years of power, it didn't do anything, and it's only coming up with these
things. That was the problem, wasn't it?
These economics of dependency, you know, building council houses so people don't own their own houses, the government give them to them, you know, giving tax credits, which is benefits by another name, and, you know, the government taking all your money and then handing it out the way they want to do it. I mean, this is a total anathema to me, and this is why I joined the Conservative Party, really, because although, you know, we want to be a caring Conservative Party, and I certainly wouldn't concur with some of the comments maybe that Howard Flight made this week, and you know, I think that's the old Tories, the way they would be speaking about things. I think that, you know, what we want to do is give people the incentives to stand on their own two feet, to have their own homes, to rent their own properties. And I'm very much in favour of this idea that we have limited tenancies now in council houses, because there are people whose circumstances change, and, you know, why should they be given a subsidised property for the rest of their life and also be able to pass it on to some of their dependents after that?
Well, the comment you mentioned about from Howard Flight was he was saying that the poorer people in society were the only ones that could have children, possibly, in the future, and that middle-class people wouldn't be able to.
What a ridiculous statement that was, wasn't it? And he used offensive language as well, you know, the breeding, you know, which is what you talk about animals. I mean, if I was David Cameron, I'd get rid of him, to be honest. I wouldn't make him appear. But, you know, that's the old party and the old Conservatives, and but I think we've got a lot of good policies coming up, and we need to move people, you know, who can now stand on their own two feet. They need to go into you know, their own houses or the private rented sector, and we need to make sure those people who need council housing to have the opportunity to get it.
But surely people are being sacked. It's a recession. It's the worst time in the world to be actually saying, sorry, but you can't have your council house.
No, I'm saying that those people should be able to, because there'll be other people who are doing okay. And we say, okay, now you're doing okay. And also there may be the retired couple who are still living in a four-bedroom council house with no kids, and you've got a family that are living in a bed and breakfast. You know, we need to look at new ways of doing things. If the government becomes just, you know, they're dealing out things to everybody in their terms, you know, instead of saying, well, okay, we're going to be a safety net for those people who need it, then, you know, that's my views anyway.
Okay, on to another story, an international one now. Britain keeps silent on Afghan imposter claim. Now, this is from one of the big US papers, and we're told that one of the chief negotiators from the Afghan people was actually nothing of the sort. He wasn't actually involved with the Taliban, and he was an interloper, even though apparently we gave him quite a lot of money in order to stay as part of these so-called peace talks. Now, it sounds like the Taliban, or not the Taliban in this case, but someone's managed to pull the wool over our eyes. Do you think the people who are from the intelligence services over there trying to negotiate a peace with these people have really got their heads screwed on, Alistair?
It sounds really bizarre story, this, doesn't it? And I think all involved were probably pretty embarrassed. I do think that there's going to be no resolution of this without involving the Taliban in some form of discussions and engagement, just in the way as, you know, Northern Ireland would never be resolved if behind the scenes somebody wasn't talking to the IRA or Sinn Féin or whatever. So, you know, it all goes on. We know it does, but I mean, this just sounds like they made some sort of classic errors here. I haven't been following the story closely myself.
Well, the British introduced an imposter posing as a high Taliban commander into the presidential palace in Kabul to meet President Karzai. News of the embarrassing ruse emerged earlier this week in an article in the New York Times, saying that a man identifying himself as Mullah Akhtar Mohammed Mansour, one of the most senior commanders of the Taliban movement, had held three meetings with NATO and Afghan officials, encouraging hopes of a negotiated settlement of the nine-year-old war. Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously, I just know what we're being told here. I mean, David Miliband, when he was Foreign Secretary, was flagging up that we were going to talk to the Taliban. Frankly, why don't we just get on with it and do it? I mean, the problem is that the Taliban's position, as I understand it, is that they won't negotiate while foreign forces are in Afghanistan. So it's a sort of and they also said anybody who comes forward and claims to be speaking for us is not speaking for us. So
there might have been a clue in that statement.
Well, there might have been, yes. But of course, the Taliban is not actually a cohesive movement, as one of the dissidents in the US armed forces said when he resigned. He said, look, we're actually fighting 120 different groups who are locally based. They are federated together. One of the groups we're fighting, for example, is the Hekmatyar group, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group, who were our allies in the 1980s, and many of his guys were trained by British SAS. But of course, he's now our enemy and we can't talk to him. I mean, all of this gets... I mean, it's a tragedy for the people of Afghanistan. It's a big mess, isn't it?
Next story, the council cuts. The rich get richer while the poor get poorer. This is from yesterday's Guardian. Community Secretary Eric Pickles is desperately trying to head off a political row after analysis shows the most deprived areas in Britain will suffer most from local authority cuts, while the richest areas will benefit. Areas like Liverpool face budget reductions of almost a third as a result of the comprehensive spending review, whilst more prosperous areas are set for a funding boost. This is an extraordinary story. Martin, do you want to start, though, Alistair?
Well, I haven't seen this story, I have to say, until I came in this evening. I don't read The Guardian, which might not surprise you. This didn't come up in The Telegraph, I have to say.
So staggering, it says, is the imbalance, according to the local government Chronicle, that the normally implacable Community Secretary Eric Pickles, who delivered his department's cuts package to the Treasury in September, has been forced to go back to the Treasury to plead for extra money to mitigate the impact on the poorest areas. Now, it does sound a little bit perverse, if it's true,
I mean, The Guardian has been known to exaggerate.
Well, it's up for negotiation. Eric Pickles is now trying to fight for more money for the poorer cities.
I think there are issues about these cuts, and some of the councils in the past, whilst Labour were in power, were getting much higher settlements than the Conservative councils. I do know that because I've worked in a number of councils during my time over the last 5 or 6 years.
Sounds like the Conservatives are doing the same now.
Well, they may be rebalancing some of the ways that it was dealt out in the past. I think that we do have to soften the blow for these councils. I'm sure that they will. You know, that I cutting huge swathes out of council budgets won't be acceptable. And I'm sure that Eric Pickles will be looking at ways to do that.
Martin?
Well, I mean, obviously, I only saw this when I came in here this afternoon.
You didn't buy your Guardian yesterday.
Well,
Martin,
I didn't read it. That's why I didn't read this particular article. I mean, if this whole question, let's face it, we have council tax, but the vast majority of what Bristol City Council spend is from the central government. Let's face it, isn't it? And so the way in which that's assessed and calculated is obviously extremely sensitive. There is a suspicion that because Labour-controlled councils are not going to, I mean, inner-city councils are not going to do what the government wants, that they, you know, then people aren't going to vote for them anyway, that they can be cut off. But we've got to basically have a fair and transparent system. In fact, we probably need to reform the system of local taxation and finance. In the past, I've said, why don't we think about going back to the rates? Much more efficient system for collecting money than the current community charge nonsense.
Now, what do you think about that, Alistair? Because you were saying you were no great lover of Margaret Thatcher, and it was her that got rid of the rates and brought in the community charge. Or
yes,
council
well, of course,
tax.
We don't have the community charge that Martin said. We have a council tax, which we've moved back to.
I mean, what do you think? Is it better to actually be taxing local people on the property that they own, or is it better to be taxing the individuals inside the property?
All taxation is unfair, and once you say, well, tax the property, then somebody says there's a little old lady who's lives in this big house and she's got a big tax bill. If you tax on incomes, then someone will say, oh yeah, but what about this poor family who's got a bit of an income, but they're having to pay lots of mortgage payments and so on and so forth. Council tax itself, where it's it's not that far removed from what the old rates used to be.
But I mean, in principle it is, isn't it? Because the rates was on the actual property and the value of the property, whereas the council tax is on the individuals in living in the property.
No, it's based on the rateable value of the property. I mean, the only difference is that if you have a one person in the property, then you get a discount for that. It's still based upon the value of the property as was assessed 20 years ago, whatever it was, when it was first done.
But it's levied on the residents, not the owner of the property, isn't it?
In the past, people used to pay their rates in their rent. So if you're in a council tenant, it would be part of a notional part of your rent that you were paying. We've actually got a bit of a dog's breakfast of a system in Britain now, because in Northern Ireland, of course, they've still got the rates. The attempt to reform the system was never even thought about because it was regarded as too explosive. I mean, we had riots on the streets of Britain when the poll tax was introduced in the mainland. But, of course, in Northern Ireland, there was no prospect of that ever happening. So you've still got the rating system in Northern Ireland. And in Scotland, the Liberals and the SNP were talking about bringing in local income tax. We're going to have to look at the whole taxation system. We're going to have to look at the way we regulate the city. And we've also got not to make macroeconomic mistakes and crash the economy. But we are going to make a macroeconomic mistake and crash the economy. But once we've crashed the economy, we're then going to start talking about rating systems, taxation systems, one-off wealth taxes. It's going to be shock and awe for the bourgeoisie.
So, Alistair, if you were, you have final word on this one. If you were the Chancellor tonight and you could tweak the taxation system, local taxation or national taxation, what would you like to see change?
I'd like to see a much flatter taxation system, and I'd like to see it starting at quite a high level so that we weren't taxing people on low incomes. But then on the other hand, I'd like to see quite a flat system that moved forward. I'd also like, I mean, quite radically, you know, looking at council tax. I mean, you know, in a number of countries, you have a local VAT type or local goods tax, and I think that would be quite a good one to look at moving forward on things.
Now, immigration is always an issue, and the Bristol has been being considered as possibly a city of sanctuary. Is this a good thing? Marina Morris has been out on the streets to ask you.
Labour's Toby Perkins.
Should Bristol become a city of sanctuary?
Only if it means something. If it's just a bit of sort of right-on sounding propaganda that doesn't mean anything, then it's a waste of time. To do that means you do something positive for refugees and asylum seekers. So only if they're going to do something positive. If not, it's a waste of time.
Yes, I do think it would be good because asylum seekers essentially are escaping danger, and I think it's important that more fortunate countries like Britain are there to support them, as long as they genuinely are asylum seekers, and I don't see a problem with it.
I obviously think it'd kind of benefit Bristol in terms of business and a wider opportunity to expand and benefit the city. So the economy and
ethnic diversity, I think that's always beneficial to have difference in culture. It makes people more tolerant, which is what everyone really needs. I think a lot of cities in Britain need that. I think sometimes it's only larger cities like Manchester and London that have that, and Bristol should have that too.
I think it depends on the housing. If there's enough resources and housing to support more people coming in, then that's absolutely fine. I'm from Liverpool and they had a lot of refugees, and there were some problems mixing, but I think in general there was not generally perceived to be a good thing, so I'm not against it.
Well, we've got enough problems about having refugees in our city. I think it's a bad idea, and I think a lot of refugees maybe are good and probably a lot of trouble in their countries they come from, but there's an awful lot of them are here for economical migrants. And I think that's a bad idea, and I think Bristol City Council should concentrate on more on the people who live in Bristol, people who live in Bristol for many, many years, than concentrate on refugees.
Bristol's something for everything. It's the cycling centres, the cycling city for the world, it's this, that and the other.
It's a very cosmopolitan city anyway, so it might do good, but there's harms to it as well. The asylum seekers, there'll be more people still claiming benefits, and it should be harsh to the other community.
Can asylum seekers and refugees make a meaningful contribution to the city and improve the community?
Of course, by bringing their talent, skills, as they've always done throughout history. Britain's dependent upon migrants and refugees and asylum seekers.
Of course they can. If they are trained in a skill, or they get training in a skill, then there's no reason why they can't get a job and contribute to the economy like everyone else.
As long as they don't sponge off the state, then there's not a problem with it, I guess.
Nurses, lots of jobs in the NHS, as well as things like plumbing, even simple things like being a hairdresser. We always need those kind of jobs in this country. And often people from less fortunate backgrounds, such as asylum seekers, I'm much more grateful for those jobs and therefore do them kind of better than, say, somebody from a more fortunate background.
I think, of course, they can. It does take efforts on both sides and good communications.
We're in a bad way, our country, in bad debt, so I don't see why we should take on asylum seekers. OK, take on immigrants, you know, legally, and are beneficial to our country, yeah, but not asylum seekers who come over here breaking the law. I'm really and truly, they should be sent back straight away. So that's my opinion, because there are a lot of people who've got sons and daughters, lived in this country for many, many, many years, and their sons and daughters can't get housing because asylum seekers are taking up all the housing. And it's not only in Bristol this is happening, it's happening in all other parts of the country.
Depends from where are they. I mean, it depends what kind of refugees, where are they from, what is their background, why are they refugees? And if they find a stable occupation, then yeah, they can make a... If they're well-educated as well, if the country can invest in them, then yeah, I think they can make a contribution in improving the country, the city.
I think they can, definitely. They can play a great part in our community.
and to improve ourselves and themselves. And we can help them along, and they can help us, and we can learn things through them. The culture and understanding of another cultures, and I think there's many other things we can learn through humanity, because there are so many different things in the world, and we cannot be blocked thinking like we know everything. We don't, and I think we can learn a lot from this.
Now, that was Marina Morris there out on the streets asking you what you thought about the issue of asylum seekers, refugees, immigrants, and whether you support the idea of Bristol being a city of sanctuary. Now, Martin, do you want to start on this one? Is it a good idea to simply be have an open door to asylum seekers and refugees?
No, there's got to be regulations about who can live where. You know, there isn't an open door at the moment. What I would pick up on is what one of the respondents were saying, that if we're going to be a city of sanctuary, is it anything more than just a branding exercise?
Well, what it is it's actually an official council policy to encourage all of the agencies around the city that the council funds to welcome asylum seekers and to help them, rather than to say, well, actually, you're a problem, we're not going to help.
I do understand why the council have said that they want to be a city of sanctuary for that reason, but the question is what resources are implied by that. I mean, frankly, they're already obliged by law to treat asylum seekers on a fair basis. And when the chap was saying there that it's illegal for them to be here, he's simply wrong. If they're a genuine asylum seekers, it's not illegal for them to be here at all.
What he was criticising was illegal immigrants. And he's saying that there is a big market for cheap labour and people coming in illegally.
There's got to be regulations about who can come and live in Britain. Everybody's agreed about that. You can't just have an open door for everybody. But it's got to be fair, it's got to be transparent, and everybody's got to know what's going on. I mean, asylum seekers are not economic migrants, by and large. They're political refugees or refugees from war. I mean, many of the Somalis, for example, who live around in this area, are refugees from war. And of course, there's always going to be problems. I mean, the other point that was made was about housing. We haven't actually built any decent council housing for a whole generation in this country. And if we had, of course, we would have knocked the property bubble on the head before it got going. That's the reason why we have to have decent social housing for people.
OK, over to you, Alistair. You're a Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim. What do you think about the City of Sanctuary?
Well, I mean, this was brought up in the council meeting last week, and it was voted through. The Conservative, I abstained. It was a named vote, so anybody can check that out. I abstained on the matter. I think I'm in two minds about this, and I think that Bristol has always welcomed people who are fleeing from oppression and torture and all the rest of it. And I think that it is extremely important to make sure that they're looked after, they're helped and rehabilitated and all the rest of it. But calling ourselves a city of sanctuary is where I think the Conservative group were somewhat nonplussed. I mean, we could call ourselves, as I agreed with one of your speakers there, you know, the cycling city, the this city, the that city. And I think it puts a label on the city, which, however it is that it's there for, I mean, as you say, it's how genuine asylum seekers are welcomed into Bristol and looked after by various voluntary agencies. But most people would take it as meaning come to Bristol and get free housing or something. So it's the way it's perceived, and I think that's why most of us abstained on the motion, because we don't want the label. We want to look after asylum seekers, and we hear lots of sob stories. We hear lots who are, you know, have terrible problems, and they come to our country and hopefully we look after them. But there are also those who come over who are bogus asylum seekers, and they're coming over because they're economic migrants, and they're jumping the queue on immigration, and I think that's wrong as well.
Okay, our final story today then is the School of Latin America's Dictators, and this is from The Guardian. Last weekend, Fort Benning in Georgia, which is also known as the School of the Americas, or has just recently changed its name to something called Western Hemisphere Institute for Cooperation, or WINSEC, was the scene of lots of demonstrations over in the United States, because apparently here is where many people are trained, many Latin Americans are trained to be terrorists down in South America. Martin, have you heard of this before? And I hear that there were several arrests as well, and the Russian Russian TV crew was even arrested trying to film the demonstration.
Well, this place is pretty notorious all over the world. It's certainly well known in Latin America. Most of the Latin American military torturers were trained there by US trainers in the 1970s and 1980s.
But could it be that the biggest terrorist training camp in the world is in the US, in Fort Benning, Georgia?
Most of these people were carrying out what they would call counterinsurgency operations against their own populations. But I think there's a very interesting article I was reading the other day from Boris Johnson about torture, and making it absolutely clear that, for as far as he was concerned, there was no justification for torture. Taking a very strong line and criticising the Obama government in the US for not pursuing these torture allegations against the previous administration. I think that's very interesting for Boris to say that, and very brave, and I very much agreed with him.
You have a very quick, you've got 15 seconds on this.
I mean, let's finish on an agreement, I think, between Martin and myself. I mean, I think that, you know, it is absolutely ridiculous, and, you know, obviously torture is absolutely out of place in any civilised society.
Conservative councillor for Westbury on Trim, Alistair Watson, thank you very much. More after the news. Radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody